From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Robert Rizza will be joining us to discuss diabetes, which has been increasing in prevalence right in sync with the epidemic of obesity in the United States. We'll look at the causes of the two types of diabetes, how their treatment differs, and also about what strategies might be effective in preventing diabetes. Then, later in the show, we'll be presenting the first in a two-part series of reports on the Medicare Reform Act, which was enacted into law last December. This complicated piece of legislation went far beyond providing a prescription drug benefit for the elderly. On the next airing of Public Health Radio, we'll be looking at the prescription drug benefit. But on today's show, we'll be discussing the pivotal role the legislation gives to HMOs and private insurance companies, and the impact that change will have on the program and its 40 million enrollees. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In the last few years, public health organizations around the country have been issuing alarming reports about the epidemic of obesity in the United States. The most recent CDC study on preventable causes of death showed that poor diet and inactivity are poised to overtake tobacco smoking and become the leading preventable cause of death among Americans, causing about 400,000 deaths in the year 2000. The CDC estimates that 64% of all Americans are overweight, including more than 30% who are considered obese, and the percentage of overweight children has doubled in the last 20 years. One serious consequence of obesity and lack of exercise is diabetes, and diabetes prevalence has been rising hand in hand with obesity. Just between 1997 and the year 2002, the number of newly diagnosed cases of diabetes rose nearly 50% from 880,000 to 1.3 million. Joining us today to discuss the diabetes epidemic is Robert Rizza. Dr. Rizza is a researcher and practicing endocrinologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, specializing in the field of diabetes. For the last few years, he has served as vice president of the board of directors of the American Diabetes Association. Robert Rizza, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Maybe we should start out at a fairly basic level and bring all the listeners up to date on our current understanding of what diabetes is, highlighting the differences between the two types of diabetes.
Well, diabetes is a disease in which your blood glucose concentration is higher than it should be. Normally, you and I, when we wake up in the morning, if we don't have diabetes, our blood glucose is between 80 and 100 milligrams per DL. And after we eat, it usually doesn't go up much over 140 or 150 milligrams per DL. Diabetes is defined as when you wake up with sort of fasting blood sugar is greater than 125, or if a two-hour after glucose tolerance test is greater than 200. Now, you can have that happen because your body is secreting absolutely no insulin, and that's what's referred to as type 1 diabetes, and that's primarily because your body has destroyed your own insulin-secreting cells. Or you could have that happen because your body is secreting insulin, but is not secreting enough, and enough is the operative word, because now various things have made your body need so much more insulin, such as gaining weight, being sedentary, or other factors, which means that you now are straining your pancreas so it cannot keep up. The diabetes in which your body has no insulin is referred to commonly as type 1 diabetes, and the diabetes in which your body is secreting insulin but not enough is referred to as type 2 diabetes.
Do you feel that diabetes should be thought of as simply a condition one lives with, like degenerative arthritis, or is it more realistic or accurate to think of it as an aggressive, even life-threatening disease?
I think that you need to be careful when you refer to words such as aggressive and life-threatening, because, you know, so many of us have diabetes. That's always very frightening to hear that this is a disease which is the number one cause of various things, because diabetes, in fact, is the number one cause of blindness, the number one cause of kidney failure, the number one cause of heart disease, probably now, and even awful things such as amputations, etc. But the important thing to recognize is that it's the number one cause of all of these things if you don't treat diabetes properly. So an answer to your question is, yes, it can be very aggressive and very destructive if you don't treat it. But if you maintain your blood sugars normal, your blood pressure normal, your blood lipids normal, then you can prevent all of these things.
Tell us a bit about the treatment of the two types of diabetes and how the treatment differs.
Type 1 diabetes, as I mentioned earlier, is a condition in which your body does not have any insulin. So to properly control type 1 diabetes, you have to recreate the situation that happens to a person who doesn't have diabetes, namely that every time that person eats, insulin enters the bloodstream to cover the food, whereas they also have insulin in between meals, referred to as a basal insulin, to cover the production of glucose by your body, namely by an organ called the liver. So a person with type 1 diabetes needs to take a shot of short-acting insulin each time they eat, generally three times a day with their meal, then an injection of long-acting insulin to cover them between meals, or they can use an insulin pump to do the same thing. And a pump simply gives you a shot of insulin with each meal, but then it infuses insulin slowly between meals to keep your body balanced. Type 2 diabetes is different. Your pancreas is still secreting insulin, but not enough. So there are various drugs that can either make you secrete more insulin, make the insulin work better, make your body make less glucose, again, your liver, or together using these drugs do all those things. But the best way is to lose weight and exercise, since when you lose weight and exercise, your body now responds better to insulin, you're better able to secrete insulin, and in fact, it reverses almost all of these abnormalities that I'm discussing with. So type 1 diabetes, injections of insulin with each meal. Type 2 diabetes, you can use drugs to change the course, or insulin if it's not working. But lifestyle is the key thing, weight reduction, exercise, and type 2 diabetes.
And then the approach toward treating high blood pressure and high blood cholesterol is a bit different in patients with diabetes. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it does and it doesn't. You see, the drugs that are so effective at lowering cholesterol, such as the so-called statins, are also very effective for lowering cholesterol if a person has diabetes, and they're the first-line drugs. There are a whole long list of blood pressure pills, but pills referred to as the ACE inhibitors, angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, or blockers, are particularly effective blood pressure pills in people with diabetes. But they're also particularly effective blood pressure pills in people without diabetes. So the drugs that we use aren't all that different. It's just the goals that we have is keeping the blood pressure, the systolic less than 120 to 130, and keeping the bad cholesterol, the LDL less than 100, are goals that you particularly follow in people with diabetes.
You mentioned that there's two types of diabetes, and I was wondering if you could tell us how common the two types are.
Well, unfortunately, type 2 diabetes is becoming very, very common, not just in the United States, but around the world. There are estimates that if you're born in the year of 2000, you have a 1 in 3 chance of developing type 2 diabetes if you don't change your lifestyle. It depends upon your age, but for instance, individuals over the age of 65, and there are different data, but suggest you may have a 20-30% chance of having diabetes. So it's very, very common. If you add something called glucose intolerance, which means your blood sugars are not normal, but they're not quite at the threshold of diabetes, those numbers double.
And then how common is type 1 diabetes?
Type 1 diabetes is about every 10 people with diabetes, generally about one of the people would have type 1 diabetes. So it's about one-tenth as common as type 2. Unfortunately, it turns out that the incidence of type 1 diabetes also seems to be increasing. And there's some data suggesting that, in fact, that may be partially because as everyone, particularly children, are becoming more obese, even though they have this type 1 immune destruction process, the extra weight is stressing their pancreas, which is making type 1 develop more rapidly and in more people. That's still an hypothesis, you know, but there's a lot of data suggesting that both of these diseases are increasing, unfortunately, you know, in both young people. And in fact, older people can get type 1 diabetes as well, and it seems to be happening in older people as well. Although I laugh, the definition of older people is clearly anyone younger than I am or older than I am.
That's a very good definition. I use it myself. Are there parts of the world that seem to be less impacted by diabetes?
It appears to be increasing throughout the world. Even areas where we consider as usually as people that have not had excessive calories, for instance, India or China or Southeast Asia, literally have epidemics of diabetes. The incidence is increasing even more rapidly in those parts of the world than here, because even minimal weight gain seems to be disastrous in those populations. Individuals that are still in rural settings, that are still in areas where exercise, activity, fitness is a large part of their life, both the incidence and prevalence of diabetes is very low. So it doesn't seem to be which country you live in. It seems to be more a matter of what's the environment in which you live, i.e., do you have limited exercise and too many calories versus do you still have extensive physical activity and the right amount of calories?
Now, I know there's some Native American tribes, especially the Pima in the western United States, in whom a majority of adults actually suffer from diabetes, or a solid majority. Can
right.
you tell us about the role of heredity in the development of the two types of diabetes?
Certainly. Is that clearly heredity is important in both. And I think that, you know, as you alluded to, is that there are many Native American populations, but there are also populations in islands in the Pacific, other populations around the world, you know, where the prevalence of diabetes is very, very high and is running very strongly in families. But the Pima Indians is a wonderful example because this is a group of people where again, there are various data looking at this in different ways, where part of the individuals who lived, you know, in the Southwest actually moved back to the highlands of Mexico several generations back, whereas another part of the individuals stayed in the United States. The group that moved back into the more rural, you know, setting where obesity is not a major problem now have very low rates of diabetes, 4%, 5%, 6%. You know, these people are still lean. On the other hand, the people that are obese in the United States, in the environment where they are currently, they may have 50-60% diabetes. So it's a great example. They share the same genes, but it's the predisposition that causes the diabetes only when you have the environmental impact of other factors, in this case being obesity and sedentary lifestyle.
I'd like to focus much of the rest of the discussion today on what we can do about type 2 diabetes, since it's so very common.
Yeah. I think the most important thing that we all can do, not just, you know, for, you know, if it happens to be a relative or yourself, or I'm a physician, so my patients, but it's for all of us, is that when you stay lean and fit, there are excellent data telling us this disease almost doesn't happen. So therefore is that, in essence, something such as 4 to 5 days a week, regular aerobic exercise, 30 to 40 minutes a day, keeping your body weight close to ideal, you can almost totally prevent this disease. That's what's so tragic about this. This is something that, you know, that is completely modifiable, you know, if we all have the ability to do this, which is not easy. There are studies now in the United States and Finland and Sweden and China where intervention studies have shown that lifestyle modification, which means getting your weight down even a few pounds and walking, you know, not running marathons, but even doing any activity whatsoever. And that's part of the ADA's program of small steps, big rewards. It's just parts of activity increasing throughout your day, changing your calorie intake can have major impacts upon this disease.
If moving toward leaner body weight and increasing exercise and activity levels are the most important methods of preventing diabetes, I'd like to actually hear more about what the American Diabetes Association has done to promote those goals.
Certainly. And I'd like to just add as a caveat that not only exercise, and again, we talk about exercises. I keep saying this is not vigorous, but vigorous is fine. This is just doing something, you know, as well as weight reduction. Not only prevents diabetes, but also it prevents heart disease, keeps your blood pressure down, and there's excellent data suggesting that it also can prevent cancer. The American Diabetes Association has been working with a variety of groups and agencies. It's been working with the federal government and its National School Lunch Program to try to help change the types of food served to our children. So emphasizing low-fat meals, low-sodium meals, trying to follow national guidelines as defined by the FDA. It's been working with state legislatures throughout the country and states all over the United States to provide opportunities for walking paths. If you're going to be redoing roads, to provide bike paths, to provide areas where people can be parking so they then can walk to their jobs or to the various facilities. And it's, I say, it's working with legislation to do this, not necessarily through laws, but by trying to modify the infrastructure. It's been working with the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, developing a national awareness program, you know, of the importance of exercise and weight loss, and a national detection program. You'll be hearing a lot about that. It has its own program, which has been a major initiative called Small Steps, you know, Large Rewards, working with people in various communities, you know, different parts of the country, both rural and inner city, to try to encourage people, using churches, using other kinds of outreach to help people realize the importance of even modest changes in activity and weight. And this act, this ADA's program has been mostly partnering with anyone, you know, who is willing, you know, to work together to try to get the message across. This is important for all of us, you know, both our families and ourselves, you know, to change the way we live.
When you're mentioning some websites a little bit later, I'm going to add one on for the September issue of the American Journal of Public Health. One of the articles in that journal, which is entirely talking about interventions people can do to communities to improve the health of those communities. And they specifically only included legal and construction types of interventions. But among the legal ones, they had one segment on fast food and trying to reduce the consumption of fast food, and came up with some ideas like prohibiting the presence of play equipment in fast food outlets.
Yeah, I know. I love that, Marvin. I mean, I was reading the list of things that you'd given me here, thinking, you know, that these are absolutely fascinating.
Require a minimum distance from youth-oriented facilities like playgrounds and schools. Limit the total number of fast food outlets in a community. These are advocates really pushing governments to really take a new attitude toward the health of their citizens. So I actually would just like to hear you comment on that and then tell us about
Marvin,
some
useful
websites.
What do you think about that? You're a practicing internist.
I support it. I think communities should plan to be safe and to be healthy.
The reason is that I turned the question around to you, is that you have as much experience as I, and I would say as a private citizen, you know, I wholeheartedly support the concept, because I think is that how in the world, you know, can we let fast foods, you know, basically cultivate our children, which is really the key. But then again, and as a physician, I think that, you know, that this is would be, a, if it were effective, because we haven't shown that it's effective, because whenever we start intervening for various ways, you know, in individuals' lives with using legal instruments, you certainly want to be sure that you're doing something that has a value. On the other hand, I also accept the fact, as both a private citizen and as a physician, that if you don't provide people with choice, the situation is unlikely to be effective over the long run. So to me, the issue is really education. You know, so if you were to say playgrounds, I don't know. You were to say fast foods in schools, I would argue that I would agree completely, because that is something that we as citizens, you know, provide to our children. So I don't know why we would have fast foods in school. So maybe what I'm just quibbling a little bit is I'm expressing my uncertainty between, you know, individual rights for choice versus helping people make the right kind of decisions as they grow up, particularly children, you know, understanding what is good for them.
Well, certainly there would be strong objections to tearing down an already existing McDonald's, but many parts of the country are expanding in population and adding housing and zoning in commercial areas. So in that situation, it might be quite reasonable for a growing community to restrict the entry of fast food outlets, especially when they're trying to locate right near a youth center or a school. And also, it may be easier to design bike paths or a park in a new community than to tear up an existing road system or take down people's houses to put in a park or a bike path. Anyway, speaking of creating healthy communities, before we started recording, you were telling me a little bit about the community you yourself live in and what you folks have done to make everyone healthier. Tell us about that.
I'd be glad to. Of course, I live in a small town in the Midwest called Rochester, Minnesota, but there has been a program referred to as CardioVision 2020, which means by the year 2020, and this has been spearheaded by Dr. Thomas Conti in the Division of Cardiology and a variety of other people working with him. But what this group has been doing is working with the school system here in Rochester to try to help improve the quality of the food that's given to the children in the schools. They're working with restaurants to identify and label foods which are high-calorie, high-fat versus those which are not. Again, leaving the choice to the people, but at least they know what they're eating. Working in order to try to avoid, you know, providing smoke-free environments, you know, within the community. Working to try to increase the opportunities for exercise, sponsoring various activity events such as, you know, 5K runs, et cetera, but heightening the awareness of the entire community, coming up with programs within the city and the various centers of activity where people can have access to exercise facilities and can come up in a way which they can modify their own lives. And you know, there's a tremendous community support. This is being done working with churches, being working with the government, the public health service, and physicians here in this community, as well as, the various members of the community. Now, has Rochester changed? I think it's changing. You know, are we there? By no means. You know, but that's how everybody works together to try to make a difference.
So I'd like to know if you would be willing to point out some websites for listeners who'd like to learn more about diabetes and its prevention.
Well, probably the website that has most of this information is the diabetes homepage, which is www.diabetes.org. And then the ADA's website links with multiple other websites that you can work your way through, you know, to provide you much of the information I've been alluding to.
Well, Robert Rizza, I'd really like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a privilege to have the opportunity to chat with you.
Coming up next, the first in a two-part investigation of the recently enacted bill to reform the Medicare program. So stay tuned. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The legislation that created the Medicare program passed the Congress and was signed into law in 1965. Its major purpose was to cover most of the medical costs for the elderly population in the U.S. Back in 1965, providing coverage for most hospital and doctor care did make a significant dent in the high cost of medical care that senior citizens received. But over time, the cost of the deductibles and copays rose, and so did many other health costs that the Medicare program doesn't cover, including dentistry, vision care, and hearing aids, among others. But no cost has risen as quickly as pharmaceutical costs. And half the prescription drugs in the U.S. are prescribed for Medicare enrollees. Many senior citizens are dependent on prescription medications, and price increases far outstripping their incomes have made it increasingly difficult for elderly Americans to afford their medicines. Many skimp on medications or don't even fill prescriptions they can't afford. So for several years, senior citizens organizations have sought relief from public officials. But many legislators in the Republican Party, which holds the majority in both houses of Congress, are opposed on principle to public sector involvement in health care, and this has made passage of legislation a daunting task. But political pressure to pass legislation was great, especially with the upcoming presidential election. So despite fundamental disagreements among various factions in Congress about how to shape the future of Medicare, backers of the Bush administration finally cobbled together a coalition of a few Democrats and many reluctant Republicans to pass a bill to reform the Medicare program. So the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act was passed last autumn, and President Bush signed it into law in December last year. While most advocates were pushing for affordable prescription drugs, the bill does much more than provide support for medication costs. Most importantly, it provides strong inducements to HMOs and private insurance companies to sign up with Medicare and compete with other companies and with traditional Medicare to provide coverage in cities and towns across the country. And it also provides a strong incentive for Medicare enrollees to sign up with the plans. The implications of the growing presence of private insurers in the Medicare program will be the focus of today's show. On the next airing of Public Health Radio, we'll take a detailed look at the prescription drug benefit. But before examining the bill itself, it would seem remiss if I fail to mention the remarkable number of scandals that have stirred up around the Medicare bill. For the last few months, media coverage of Medicare has almost exclusively focused on these scandals. Here's a segment from the National Public Radio's afternoon news program.
At least three separate investigations are underway into the Bush administration's handling of the Medicare bill, how the measure got passed, and how it's being sold to the public. The administration was hoping to tout the Medicare bill with its new drug benefit as a major domestic policy achievement for the president. Now that's in some doubt.
I'll quickly review some of these scandals before delving into the details of the bill itself. I'll mention eight apparent improprieties and investigations, but there may be others. No one would be surprised. One scandal that has received little attention has to do with the financing of the president's re-election campaign. Just 2 days after the bill was introduced last June, the trade group for the pharmaceutical industry hosted a fundraising dinner for President Bush. Donors contributed $30 million to the president's re-election campaign that evening, still a record for a one-day political fundraiser. GlaxoSmithKline, a drug company based in Britain, donated $250,000, and so did Pharma, the drug industry's lobbying group. Several other scandals and investigations relate to the tactics the Bush administration used to draw up the final bill and getting enough votes for the bill to pass. In a move with few precedents, the Democratic Party leadership of both houses of Congress were kept out of the House-Senate Conference Committee which drew up the final bill. Despite the lure of campaign contributions, most Democrats and many Republicans opposed the bill right up to the last minute. In fact, the arm-twisting that took place to get the bill passed took the entire day last November when the vote was scheduled. Even when the vote finally took place at 3 a.m. the next day, the bill went down to defeat. So the House leadership violated the rule that restricts votes to 17 minutes and didn't close the voting until enough Republicans had changed their votes to get the bill passed by a slim margin. One of the several investigations centering around the bill is exploring pressure exerted by the Republican leadership on Nick Smith, a member of their own party from the state of Michigan. Smith opposed the legislation and refused to change his vote. He's planning to retire, and Smith's son is running in his district to replace his dad in that congressional seat. Smith Sr. stated publicly on a radio program that he was promised $100,000 would be channeled to his son's campaign by the National Republican Party if he were to change his vote. When he refused, he was told that the National Republican Party would instead work to defeat his son. Investigation of what appears to be a bribe is ongoing by the House Ethics Committee. Then, after the bill was passed, $23 million of public money was devoted to touting the bill's benefits to a skeptical public. A formal congressional investigation is looking into allegations that these ads have crossed the boundaries of objectivity in their characterization of the bill. More controversy still has centered around the fact that a firm called Ketchum PR Worldwide was selected to develop this public relations campaign. Ketchum turns out to be the same PR firm the Bush campaign has employed to spearhead his political campaign for re-election to the presidency. Only a few weeks after passage of the bill, the director of the Medicare program, Tom Scully, left his post to take a lucrative position with a law firm that does extensive business with the pharmaceutical industry. And Billy Towson, chair of the House Commerce Committee, was recently offered a $2 million a year job working for Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry trade group. Then, in the most recent scandal, the administration's actuary, Rick Foster, admitted that he had given the Bush administration a 10-year projection of the bill's costs of $530 billion, more than 30% higher than the $395 billion estimate legislators voting on the bill were given. He stated publicly that Tom Scully, his boss, had threatened him with immediate firing if he divulged his higher estimate to Congress or to the press. And it was held under wraps until 2 months after the vote took place. Investigation of this apparent impropriety is ongoing. So the bill has faced a good deal of unfavorable press, leading to widespread public concern. Each of these scandals certainly has led to interesting media coverage, but it's somewhat unfortunate that all these improprieties and scandals have crowded out coverage of what the bill actually does. So to learn more about the Medicare reform bill, I spoke with Leslie Norwalk, the deputy administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal agency that administers the Medicare program. I asked her to summarize some of what the 700-page piece of legislation includes.
Boy, there's a whole lot in this new law. Everything from increasing payments to physicians to keep them in the Medicare program, to adding a preventative benefit for those who were new to Medicare in 2005, to adding a drug benefit in 2006. And that's probably what's been talked about the most.
Another measure within the bill prohibits reimportation of drugs from Canada and other foreign countries until the FDA is able to certify their safety. The same objection the administration has had to drug reimportation since it took office. Unfortunately, neither Congress nor the Bush administration has directed the FDA to undertake a reimportation safety certification program, and the Medicare reform bill doesn't do so either. But more on the drug benefit a little later. While the media have focused coverage related to the bill on the prescription drug benefit itself, as well as all the scandals, a primary goal of the Bush administration has been to solidify and expand the position of private insurance plans and HMOs in the Medicare program. In fact, the Bush administration originally proposed that Medicare offer prescription drug coverage only to seniors who enroll in private insurance plans. But since these plans may not choose to even enter rural or poor areas, legislators in both parties pushed the Bush administration to allow individuals who remain in traditional Medicare to also have access to the new prescription drug benefit. So the administration came up with a different method to lure enrollees into private insurance plans. They set aside $46 billion for these plans to make sure they would work with Medicare. And the increased payments to these plans are so substantial that the private sector plans are now able to provide more generous benefits than traditional Medicare. Involvement of private sector plans in Medicare is not new. In fact, private sector plans have been contracting with Medicare for about 15 years. Over this period of time, study after study revealed that Medicare was losing money by including these plans in the program. This was because the private companies invariably ended up with healthier enrollees than Medicare's average enrollee. I asked Judy Fader, Dean of the Public Policy Institute at Georgetown University, about how private plans have performed in the Medicare program over the last 15 years.
Insurers, when it comes to managing care or managing costs, have a couple of options. They can make a real effort to coordinate people's care, to reduce duplication and other kinds of inefficiencies that occur in when we seek health care on their own. Or they can reduce costs by placing barriers in the way of receiving services and benefits, and by enrolling healthy people and disenrolling sick ones. Experience with a lot of managed care in both for the younger as well as the older population indicates that it's much easier for them to put barriers in the way of benefits and avoid giving care to people when they're sick than it is for them to truly manage care. And that is definitely the experience we have had in managed care in the Medicare program.
Personally, I was not at all surprised when I first learned about this. In all my years working in hospitals and nursing homes, places where plenty of senior citizens congregate, I've never seen a single recruiter from a private plan or HMO attempt to enroll Medicare beneficiaries. But of course, hospitals and nursing homes wouldn't exactly be the best locations to only find healthy senior citizens. But though every study yet commissioned confirmed that the plans always enrolled healthy people, administrators of both parties insisted on encouraging the growth of the private sector programs. This became an especially high priority when the Republican Party assumed control over both houses of Congress in 1994. Listeners may recall the speech of the new Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, about traditional Medicare. He predicted it would wither on the vine and be replaced by private insurance companies. So instead of dropping a program which provided no apparent benefit and seemed to be wasting taxpayer money, the Medicare administrators instead tried to develop strategies to prevent the plans from attempting to selectively recruit healthy seniors to sign up into their plans. Those of you who are listening who are young may not realize that not only are most young people healthy, but the vast majority of elderly people are also quite healthy and cost the Medicare program virtually nothing. I asked Bob Berenson about the issue. For 3 years, Berenson directed the Center for Health Plans, the office within the Medicare program that regulates the private plans. I wondered about the people who actually are sick. How much of Medicare's budget do they cost the taxpayers?
About 5% of beneficiaries are responsible for about 50% of the costs. They tend to have more than 5 chronic conditions. They are just very sick people. And in fact, some HMOs have told me confidentially that they actually do develop better programs for these people because it's both to improve quality and to hold down costs, but they don't want anybody to know about them because the way it works is you get penalized if you have a program that does a good job with sick people.
I asked Leslie Norwalk, the director of the Medicare program, about the attempts of private plans to avoid recruiting the chronically ill Medicare enrollees. So my concern about the notion that the insurance companies offering these plans are going to be in a very strong position.
A strong position in what way?
How do you mean? They are going to have information about what their plan offers and, more importantly, who they want to sell the plan to. This is something that probably is not legal.
Exactly.
Technically.
It isn't legal.
For them to figure out who they're going to sell the plan to.
Well, the statute, not this statute, but one that was passed 10 years ago, prohibits discriminating on, this is a federal statute, that prohibits the discrimination on the basis of health status related factors. Basically, you can't cherry pick. But there's another point to that.
But they can cherry market, can't they?
No. In fact, they cannot. So we govern their marketing materials as much as anything else. They cannot, for example, have market their plan in a gym. They can't market it on the third floor of a building with no elevator. Those things are prohibited.
How far does that... I mean, there was an article a week ago in the New York Times. You probably saw this, but if you didn't, I'll read you three sentences out of it. There's a free lunch virtually every day for Medicare enrollees in the roadside restaurants of Hernando County, which is just 50 miles north of Tampa, Florida. And no fewer than five HMOs are scrambling to sign up elderly members there. Pitches being delivered over lunch tables. And then they point out that the Bush administration is pumping $46 billion extra beyond what they had planned to into Medicare HMOs over the next decade. Humana was the last of the three Medicare HMOs that pulled out of that county 3 years ago, and they returned 2 weeks ago, offering free health club memberships. So here you've got a company offering free health club memberships. This is likely to not appeal to people with Alzheimer's disease or emphysema or heart disease. So obviously they're marketing toward a certain crowd, and they're marketing toward people who are capable of driving a car to a restaurant out on a county
road. Or being
road.
Driven.
Maybe.
The other...
I don't understand how you can micromanage their marketing. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Here's how the... here's another point that's somewhat... That's certainly related, but... which is that we pay health plans on the basis of how healthy or sick their enrollees are. Those health plans who have healthier enrollees get paid less. Those health plans who enroll sick enrollees get paid more for their enrollee. And every year we're doing more and more to take into account every single disease state there is so that we can pay our costs to them that predict the health of their population. So if they have a very healthy population, they will get paid less for it. So I'm not sure that the incentive is there to cherry pick as much as one would assume.
I asked Robert Berenson about these risk adjustment methods, since he was involved in their developments, in developing these attempts by the Medicare program to pay private plans less money when they select healthier enrollees.
Inevitably, health plans can stay ahead of any system that would try to adjust the payments for risk and will do better than not under this kind of a system. There is, to add one more thing, there's a formal program of risk adjustment of premiums. Essentially, if in fact plans do recruit members who are healthier than average, they will get paid less than the average through a complicated risk adjustment system that's based on diagnoses that people are given by their doctors. But that is an untested system, and it won't be probably good enough. We don't really know how it's going to work.
Ms. Norwalk actually seemed very optimistic about it. She emphasized that repeatedly and really felt that they can risk adjust any disparity in where the healthy people are.
Well, she's overstating it. I mean, theoretically, the best risk adjuster, if it were fully implemented and it worked well, can basically predict 20 to 25% of the favorable selection that somebody might get. It's basically untested, and it's premature to have gone on this huge demonstration of turning Medicare over to private plans.
There are many costs that private plans carry that are simply not present in Medicare. Each insurance company has to send out its own provider relations team to negotiate fee schedules with doctors and hospitals and labs and other medical providers, and each is expected to pay their CEOs the usual executive compensation package. And each is expected to provide dividends to their investors, and each pays for government relation teams of lobbyists, and each will develop and implement a marketing plan and produce TV ads and pay to air them and decide how to get potential enrollees to their free lunches and to their health club memberships. These expenses add up and generally average over 20% of insurance company revenue. Given that the private plans are starting out with about 20% higher costs than Medicare faces, I asked Ms. Norwalk what methods she envisioned the health plans could use to save money compared to the expenses of traditional Medicare. But she offered no suggestions. So I wondered what benefit there is to including private plans in the program. She pointed out the benefit to Medicare enrollees that had already occurred since Medicare began paying the private plans more money.
The number of plans recently just totally reduced to zero the premiums charged to beneficiaries. There are a lot of different ways to compete. Why is competition good? If you are someone who has trouble hearing, many seniors do. Medicare doesn't have a hearing benefit or a hearing aid benefit, for example. So it might be that the most important thing for you is to be on a plan that covers your hearing aids. So is one of those available in your area? Yes, that's a good thing. Well, there may be another plan that doesn't cover hearing aids, but maybe it covers vision benefits or something else. Or maybe it reduces the premiums and the most important thing to you is catastrophic coverage and just your pocketbook.
So the clever elderly person could potentially enroll in one plan to pick up a hearing aid, then switch plans the next year to pick up a pair of glasses, and then in the third year, switch to the inexpensive plan. And then, if they become ill, enroll in the plan that's good for sicker patients, assuming that plan could survive the competition, that is. Since doctors aren't likely to enroll in every insurance plan, Ms. Norwalk's scenario also means that the patients will be switching from one panel of doctors to another each year as they switch insurance companies. This would mean transferring often lengthy records from one doctor's office to the next and getting to know a new doctor each year. I asked Judy Fader about how desirable it actually is for elderly people to act as prudent consumers when it comes to something as personal as their relationship with their doctor.
People want to make choices that, or want to have arrangements that they can stay with and that they can count on, and that it is unrealistic to expect people to change plans based on price only, because there are we have relationships with our providers, particularly if we have medical conditions that require a lot of medical care. The experience of federal retirees tells us that there is a tremendous tendency among retirees, among older people, to stay in plans, perhaps because they are so accustomed to the arrangements they've had, and that it's not an easy thing to change every year. So the concept that people would do that all the time, it would be a disruptive thing, and it's unrealistic.
Well, let's take a short break. I'm Marvin Malik. We've been discussing the Medicare Reform Act, enacted last December. While beneficiaries were seeking a prescription drug benefit, the bill does much more. Most significantly, it greatly expands the role of private insurers and HMOs in the program, and that's what we've been focusing on today. After the break, we'll take a look at how the new Medicare program will deal with patients suffering from Alzheimer's disease and other cognitive deficits who have difficulty contending with HMOs and private insurance plans. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik. On today's show, we've been discussing the expanded involvement of private insurance plans in the Medicare program. 40% of 85-year-olds have Alzheimer's disease, and many younger senior citizens also have significant cognitive impairments. I asked Leslie Norwalk, the Deputy Administrator of the Medicare program, how Medicare will address the problems enrollees with Alzheimer's and other diseases that affect the brain are likely to have, and whether it's realistic to expect these patients to evaluate insurance contracts and effectively advocate for their needs once they're enrolled in one of these private plans.
Well, certainly we're concerned too, which is to say it's important that we get the word out. Healthcare insurance is, no matter what variety, is complicated. We are spending a significant amount of time reaching out, not just to those individuals who are Medicare beneficiaries, but we'd also like to make sure that their families know how to contact us, how their caregivers know, and as much as you as a physician might be asked, gee, what should I do? That's important. Now, I don't know how it is that you get informed consent from regarding an Alzheimer's patient, for example, but the same way that you would get informed consent, those same individuals would be the individuals I would expect to learn about and help make the individual decide whether or not, if the individual can decide, in fact, on him or herself, or make the decision for the individual pursuant to healthcare power of attorney or whatever other consent is appropriate in a state. Anyway, to figure out how it is that this all works. So we need to provide materials for everybody. So we've done everything from set up a very comprehensive website, which is www.medicare.gov. My father's a Medicare beneficiary. When he has questions, I could go to the Medicare website, and I love the Internet. Actually, he likes the Internet, too, but I appreciate that there are many people of that generation who decide that the Internet is not working for them. In any event, it's available, whether it's for caregivers or individual beneficiaries. We also have a 1-800 number that is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have changed the number of operators we've had. We've increased from 400 operators last year at this time to 1,400 operators so that we can get these questions answered as quickly as possible and as accurately as possible. In addition, we have increased funding to state programs. They're called State Health Insurance Assistance Programs. But we're basically doing what we can to provide all the information for individuals, caregivers, beneficiaries, whomever, so that we can be better consumers.
Leslie, I just don't see how you're going to make prudent consumers out of people who suffered strokes or are at early stages of Alzheimer's. And their family support system are often really overwhelmed. I just can't see adding to their burden by asking them to deal with insurance companies. And I think the plan with the best advertising and promotional materials will be the winner, regardless of what their performance actually is.
It's not as if these companies can just go out and offer whatever they want. We, in fact, approve everything that they do, everything from ensuring that they have sufficient access to providers, to the marketing material, to the benefits they offer, to their appeals process. And in fact, we'll have our own appeals process in as much as something would the beneficiary thought that he or she was entitled to something, whether it be a drug or other service, they would have an opportunity to appeal outside of the health plan in order to get their concerns addressed. In addition, the law adds a Medicare ombudsman specifically for the point that you mentioned so that we can ensure that individuals and beneficiaries, particularly knowing how vulnerable they often are, have all the protections that they need. So the government in that regard is their agent. We're not just letting these plans do whatever it is they like. We pay very close attention to them, and they are closely watched so that they cannot engage in any behavior that would be disadvantageous to the seniors.
So clearly, the Medicare program will be forced to greatly expand its bureaucracy in order to provide lists of qualified Medicare plans to each metro area's enrollees and families, and to put in place a large policing and regulatory apparatus clear across the country to guard against selective marketing to healthy Medicare enrollees. And yet these efforts will likely fall short. As we heard earlier, the regulations prohibit plans from recruiting in gyms, but allow Humana and other plans to provide health club memberships. In light of this, I asked Judy Fader and Bob Berenson to comment on the likely impact the Medicare reform bill will have to greatly expand the role of private insurance companies in the Medicare program.
We are paying them more to provide benefits, even the traditional benefits, than we would be paying if people stayed in traditional Medicare. There is no evidence that these plans are gaining efficiencies. So we could absolutely change the benefits in traditional Medicare and do so at less, not higher, cost to the taxpayer.
You know, let me just add, there was an interesting transformation that happened in the political debate this last year. At the beginning, Republicans were arguing that these private plans were more efficient, but then in the face of the overwhelming research data that shows that, in fact, Medicare spends a lot more money to private plans for them to provide the same services that traditional Medicare spends, the rhetoric got changed to choice, that people want choice of insurance companies. I don't know who wants a lot of choice of insurance companies. People want choice of providers, especially when they're sick. So choice, it's how can you be against choice? But when you think about it, the Medicare program has been working quite well for more than 35 years now. But to just have a whole bunch of HMOs and PPOs whose function in the private sector is to negotiate fee schedules with doctors and hospital rates with hospitals, why we need that in the Medicare program is beyond me. And what we are now doing is essentially bribing these plans to come back into the program by paying them, about 107 to 108% of what we pay traditional Medicare. And in some parts, like that county in Florida you were mentioning, we pay as much as 120 or 130% more than we would in the traditional Medicare program. And then they have an incentive to try to skim the relatively healthy. So we'll wind up paying not a few percent more, but clearly double-digit percents more for these private plans just to provide the basic services. So we could be doing all of this. It's been a political choice. It's not a evidence-based choice.
Well, that's it for today's show. Next month, we'll be airing the final part of our coverage of the Medicare reform bill, focusing on the prescription drug benefit. If you want to give us feedback, or if you're interested in links to learn more about the topics we discussed today, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. At the website, you'll also have the opportunity to listen to our previous shows. Well, thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio. We'll be right back.